Well, welcome to the last of our spring seminar series. What Gregor and I are going to try and do today is sort of wrap up some of the themes. And I thought I would start by concentrating on really the impact on Māori of colonisation. And I thought I'd start by just showing you a couple of pictures. We've got a picture here of King Tawhiel, the second Māori king, which in many respects, I guess, kind of represents what a lot of people think of the image of Māori leadership in the 19th century, you know, the sort of warrior. And I thought I'd contrast that with James Carroll, the first Māori to be elected to a general electorate. There's Carroll here anyway, sitting with Henare Kaiho, Richard Seddon, and the Māori king towards the end of the 19th century. And we've got here these guys who are now perhaps, you know, representing that sort of changing face of Māori leadership. And I just thought it was a kind of interesting sort of comparison to make in terms of these guys now by the 1890s are the sort of quintessential European politician in terms of how they look. Carroll becomes the first Māori to be elected to a general seat when he switches and gets elected to what ultimately becomes the seat that's known as Gisborne, is the acceptable face of Māori as the 19th century comes to a conclusion. He hasn't fought in the wars. He isn't seen as in any way challenging sort of mainstream sort of settler views, etc. Because one of the things I want to focus on today is the concern I have that we often tend to rush through the 1890s. It's a huge topic trying to do the 19th century. But if we accept that there's maybe 100 to 120,000 Māori in 1800, and we don't know. I mean, these are based on reasonable estimates or educated guesses, but there's no census. There's no way in which those figures can be, you know, very reliable. But there seems to be universal consensus now among historians that seems to be an acceptable number to sort of play around with. So by 1840, that figure's down to around, 70,000? Mainly as a result of disease and warfare. Within 18 years, if we're to believe the numbers that are gathered in 1858, Māori are now the minority. Incredible, really. I mean, if you're looking at massive change, 18 years to go from being the majority to the minority is pretty astonishing. I think it's a really important sort of date. But it's interesting that year when they do the count that the Māori population, which is now less than 59,000, is qualified with a statement as far as can be ascertained. That's the official wording. And which they're kind of conceding that there's a bit of sort of guesswork going on there as well. So it may be or maybe isn't the year in which Māori become the minority, but it seems to have become accepted in New Zealand history circles that seems to be a sort of a reasonable sort of period. And so therefore we get this sense that the 1850s is a period in which there's this kind of rapid demise of Māori. Really, this is the sort of build-up to war. Treaty signed, yeah, there's a bit of stoush in the 1840s, but really the 1850s seems to have been characterised as this period in which settlers come in greater numbers, settlers get their own parliament, responsible government, Māori react with the kingitanga in 1858, and therefore we're sort of on the brink of war. And that seems to be a fairly standard sort of analysis. But I think one of the dangers is that I think the 1850s is a period that needs a lot more exploration. And so I'm going to tease some of those ideas out with you today. So if we accept that the guts of the topic is the transformation of New Zealand from a Māori world to a Pākehā world, okay, that change from 1800 to 1900, which is characterised by rapid decline of Māori population. I mean, what is it by the end of the 19th century? It's just dipped under 40,000. And the non-Māori population is 700-odd thousand. Even in the first decade of the 20th century, when the Pākehā population pushes through the million barrier, Māori population is still only around 50,000. So we are talking, you know, about this rapid and massive sort of transformation. So if we're saying that's really the guts of the topic is how do we get from there to there, it's really easy, I think, to kind of get overwhelmed by the numbers and to get overwhelmed by the wars and everything else that goes on and actually not realise that for significant parts of the country and for long periods of time, that's not the relationship between Māori and Pākehā. I mean, in the South Island, less than 1% of the population is Māori. So race relations kind of isn't even an issue. It's not even something that people kind of register for much of the 19th century. And so when there's all that massive economic development in the South Island, you know, Māori really aren't even sort of involved in that process, okay? So really, I guess, a lot of the time when we're talking about race relations, we are talking about a North Island thing, okay? We're talking about that particular relationship. We know that with the population decline, rapid loss of land. If you can come up with some numbers, I think examiners are going to be a lot more impressed. I'll give you some of those figures later. But essentially, you know, by the early 20th century, we're looking at about Māori holding on to about 10% of their land that they'd had in 1840. How has most of it been lost? It hasn't been lost on the battlefield. It's been lost in the land court. Okay, so we're going to pick up on that sort of idea as well. So I am going to kind of, I guess, on one level continue that theme of doom and gloom and disaster for Māori. But I also want to look at ways in which we can also look at a different interpretation. And the first one I want to look at is what my friend David Green here, and I still recommend this as a good general book to kind of get your head around some of the ideas. I think Frontier of Dreams, I know the title's a little bit cheesy and stuff, but I think there's some really useful bits in there. David's one of the historians here at the ministry. David's chapter here, The Explosive Frontier, I really recommend. If you lay your hands on this book, I think it's worth a read. I want to talk about the 1850s, which is the beginning of this period that David is talking about. Because as I said before, the 1850s, we often say, okay, this is really the settler population starts to take off. And some people have sort of said in the past, it's kind of the beginning of the end for Māori. You know, this is the decade of massive change, political change especially. And I guess that's the message I've tended to push in the past as well. But really, if you just take a moment to step back and look at it, we can also say that the 1850s is a time of great prosperity for a large chunk of it for many, many Māori communities. Māori dominate trade. Māori dominate the New Zealand economy for a good chunk of the 1850s. When the European settlers start arriving in large numbers, most of them, and I think Gregor will pick up on this as well, most of them don't come here with a strong farming background. You know, we've got this, we've always sort of hung on to this idea that somehow, the people who came here just became great farmers. Well, they didn't. Most of them didn't have that farming background. They didn't also have the land that they needed, even if they had been good farmers. So very quickly, they become dependent on Māori for food. Okay, the European population, places like Auckland, you know, surrounded by significant Māori population either side, becomes totally dependent on Māori in places like the Waikato and the sort of Thames area for their food. Vast Māori enterprises are developed in things like flour mills. There's something like 60 flour mills established in the North Island, about half of those in the Waikato alone, all owned and operated by Māori. These are significant economic ventures. Some of these come back to bite Māori later because they overinvest. But in the initial period of that sort of late 1840s through to the 1850s, Māori are making money out of those sort of ventures. Māori are exporting produce, food, to places like Victoria. I've been hammering that Victorian connection the whole way through these seminars. But when the goldfields in Australia, the Victorian goldfields, Māori begin exporting food to Victoria during that period. In 1854, 2,000 waka bought more than £16,000. That's just under $2 million in today's money worth of produce to Auckland alone to export to Melbourne. We've got Ngāti Mutunga on the Chatham Islands who are using slaves to grow potatoes that they are exporting to the Californian goldfields. So while there is this kind of, you know, while the sheep are spreading across the South Island and while the settler population is increasing in the North Island, we've always got to remember that it's not as if just all of a sudden a switch is flicked and Māori go from sort of, you know, being in control to not being in control. Okay, there's a really sort of strong, vibrant Māori economy that is ensuring that they remain important players in what is happening in New Zealand at that particular time. The, I guess the thing that does start to hurt Māori, however, isn't just the explosion in numbers of settlers, it's the fact that some of them get a little too ambitious. They start to borrow to invest in things like their flour mills. And when the Australians, and also when the farming in Canterbury gets more established, people start looking away from Māori. Because it had been something that a lot of settlers had struggled with. They didn't like the idea of being dependent on Māori. This isn't why they had travelled halfway across the world. And so in the later 1850s, as farming is established on the Canterbury Plains for things like wheat, as Australia starts to produce some of its own food, the Māori economy does start to hit a few speed bumps, and those who have invested in things like flour mills and things find that they've overextended themselves, that they've had to sell land to pay for the sort of debts and to sort of clear things up. And so it's that as much as the kind of outbreak of war in 1860 that starts to put the sort of skids under the Māori economy. And in fact, even when the war breaks out, there are complaints that Māori traders in Auckland are still doing business. And some people are saying, well, this doesn't seem right. We're supposed to be at war with these people. How come we're still trading with them? Well, they're still trading with them because they depend on it. You know, Māori agriculture is what's keeping a lot of these communities going. So there's always that kind of interesting thing of war that people still tend to see as being this kind of widespread thing. But in many instances, you know, there are still large numbers of Māori for whom the wars have no day-to-day relevance. David makes a point which I think is really worth noting, and I think it's quite a nice little line to sort of use if you can. He says that more Māori allied themselves with Pākehā than fought against them. And again, I think that's a really important point to make. And I'm not talking necessarily about the argument about kūpapa Māori or something even as overt as that. But I think that, you know, again, that comment Balich makes about pre-treaty New Zealanders saying that violence is the exception, not the rule. I mean, I think we can extend that across the 19th century. The wars are significant. The wars are devastating for the iwi involved, but for significant numbers of other Māori, you know, the wars have no great impact. Ngāti Porou, another good example. Michael King talks about the way in which Māori who are seen as kūpapa come out of the whole period not too bad. You know, they get to retain their land and stuff. Ngāti Porou are another good example of an iwi that remains isolated. You know, once the civil wars of the 1860s have sort of sorted themselves, very quickly a number of Ngāti Porou get involved in thriving businesses in terms of coastal trading and things like that. In fact, you know, many Māori sailors could be seen sort of, you know, working out of places like Auckland and Gisborne throughout a lot of the 19th century. You know, so that's another area where Māori have proven themselves to be sort of really important in the history of Ngāti Porou. And if you go to Te Ara, one of our other websites, and go to the iwi section, you can click on each tribe. And it's probably worth having a look in there because, again, I think a good answer in history is always going to be acknowledging the fact that while on some level we generalise about Māori, we've always got to remember that for each iwi it's a different story. That sure, there are some generalisations we can make, but at certain times that can become quite dangerous, and we need to accept that for each iwi, the experience in the 19th century is very different.